This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Peak oil. It isn't what you think, and it hasn't gone away. From Berlin, I'll interview Christian Kirschner about a new European-American university study on energy depletion. It will change our civilization. But what is Radio EcoShock all about? Find out as Janaya Donaldson of Peak Moment TV interviews me. And of course, I'll take my turn asking Janaya, why are we all living in the peak moment of human history? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Has peak oil been blown away by shale tar sands and fracking? What industries are already in trouble with today's high oil prices? A joint study between the University of Maryland and a Barcelona university digs deep into our energy future. Our guest is Christian Kirschner. He's with the Institut de Ciencia y Tecnología.
It's the Institute of Environmental Science and Technology from the Autonomous University of Barcelona.
We've reached Christian in Berlin. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. Hi, Alex.
Well, first of all, what stimulated this joint university project called Economic Vulnerability to Peak Oil?
This research is part of, or the outcome of, my PhD research. I did a PhD in ecological economics, and from the very beginning on, this was motivated by concerns of supply restrictions of resources and limits to growth. And this is how I came across the topic of peak oil. And I realized that there was a great need of studying impacts and what this would mean for the economies.
I thought only alternative energy thinkers took peak oil seriously. Isn't it unusual for universities to study this?
Not at all anymore. I mean, this might have been the case for some time. I would say that peak oil in general is slowly entering a mainstream audience, only that they might use different wordings for it. For example, there's been also reports by the US and German armed forces, so already some time ago, about the phenomenon. There are now research projects funded by the state, for example, in Austria, and, in terms of adaptation and reducing the risks and so on.
And to be clear, you and your co-authors are not saying that oil is running out anytime soon, are you?
No, not at all. This is a great misunderstanding of the resource debate. Peak oil is not about running out. What we are running out is cheap oil. So we're not running out of oil, but of cheap oil and cheap energy. And in fact, if you want to say it like this, we will never really run out of oil. It's just that at some point, it's going to be so expensive that we're going to buy it only for certain applications and in small quantities. Like it is already the reality today in very poor countries where people buy petrol and kerosene in liter bottles.
And Christian Kirschner, although you are in Europe, your study picked the American economy as your model. Why is that?
There are many reasons for that. One is that the US is the biggest consumer of oil. It's one of the largest, or the largest economy of the world. And as a scientist, you also always have the restriction of data availability, which has to be taken into account. And there's very good data for the U.S. And although I'm European, the rest of the team that was involved in this project, they are now working in the U.S., as you know. So there were several reasons for this approach, of this choice of case study.
There's a very good graphic that accompanies your paper in the journal Global Environmental Change. It helped me to understand the paper. Could you try and describe the vulnerability map?
Yes. This is the key outcome that depicts what we found, and we chose the graph especially to make it visible what it means, what we found out, or what we tried to show. We have here a graph where you see bubbles, and the bubbles basically represent economic sectors. And the size of the bubbles represents their vulnerability to peak oil. For this, we used price increases. So if you have a price increase of of oil in general in the US, how much would the prices of the outputs of those sectors or the products of those sectors increase according to the model we have used? This is the size of the bubble. Then you have the x-axis. On the x-axis, we show the importance of the sector in terms of contribution to GDP. And on the y-axis, we show importance in terms of structure. In terms of structure, this means that how important is this sector for all other sectors? How many relations does it have to other sectors? It might be an insignificant sector like plastics, for example, which doesn't bring a lot of income, but a lot of the other sectors depend on its output. So it's structurally important. And then you end up with this graph and you end up with different interpretations, of course, but the way we see it as one interpretation is that those sectors of the top right, which are very big, large circles, big bubbles, highly vulnerable, that they are a problem for the entire economy. Why? Because they are really important in terms of the structure and income. So we really need them. And at the same time, they are very vulnerable. So if prices increase, if we have scarcities, then those sectors could put the entire economy into trouble.
Well, getting to the findings, what sectors and industries are most vulnerable to peak oil?
Okay, I'm only going to mention a few examples. One of them would be the metals industry. Another very, very obvious one is transport industry, especially air transport. And then we have fertilizers and the petrochemical industry, which is also quite obvious.
I don't understand why the metals industry is included.
Well, the metal industry is one of the most energy-intensive sectors that we have. You need a lot of energy in order to produce the products of those sectors.
Okay. Well, can you go into more detail about the impact of one particular industry exposed to higher oil prices or supply constraints?
Okay. If you take it like this, the inputs of a certain sector, let's take fertilizers, for example. Now, fertilizer industry is subject to higher oil prices. This means fertilizers become more expensive. The outputs of that sector are more expensive. This can lead to a shock wave of price increases down the supply chain of that sector. And since that sector will be very important and will have a large supply chain, it will affect the economy quite a lot and make a lot of the products that we need every day a lot more expensive. So for fertilizers, it would be food production. It does not mean, at the same time, that this sector will go bankrupt. On the contrary, it could have different results. That sector could still be very prosperous in a way. It depends on the substitution possibilities.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking peak oil from a new study done by universities in the United States and Europe. Our guest is Christian Kirchner, a specialist in ecological economics. I expect some investment firms will look closely at your findings. For example, a pension fund may not want to buy 30-year bonds in airlines or chemical plants. What can you tell us about that?
As I said already before, this is a complete wrong interpretation of our findings. In fact, it could mean the opposite. Not necessarily, of course, but it could mean that the fertilizer industry, for example, or take another industry, that it becomes it's very good for it because it's surviving in exchange of some other sectors which might disappear. It all depends on how possible it is to substitute the outputs of that sector and how essential that sector really is.
We generally, Christian, tend to think of fossil fuels becoming limited or at least more expensive because of resource constraints, but there are extreme weather events and fires attributed to climate change. Did your team consider a future bottleneck due to either carbon taxes or public boycotts of industries even damaging the atmosphere?
No, we did that. We did not do that in this time round, but our model allows an interpretation for such or an inclusion of such scenarios. And what's more, it can actually help to design carbon policies, for example. You can easily use the model to determine which of the sectors you want to phase out, for example, or which you want to protect, and others which you want to get rid of or which you don't want to have them so important for your economy.
In addition to peak oil and resource scarcity, you personally have also studied and published about steady state economics. And again, I may have a misunderstanding here, but I thought that an economy which survives on its own carbon use would have to be much smaller. What do you say to that?
I agree. This is why I also talk about degrowth. as a necessary, degrowth in a socially benign way, a process to reduce our energy and material throughput in the rich countries to bring them to a level that is sustainable globally.
We've had some degrowth conferences, so there is a lot of discussion about that. I want to get back to your study, Economic Vulnerability to Peak Oil. I was intrigued by the concept that energy flows may be limited simply by available technology, if I understood it. Does that imply no matter how much money we throw at developing fossil fuels, we may hit a ceiling, a point where the return on investment is just too low to continue?
Yes, of course. That's absolutely right. Below a certain ratio of energy input versus energy output, a resource becomes or fails to be a primary energy resource. Once you get less energy out than you put in the first place, you will not use that resource anymore, no matter how high the price is. It's not going to be an energy resource. You might use that product like oil for other applications, more higher priced applications, but not as a primary energy resource. Technology can, of course, improve that ratio. There's a nice example of peak oil is sometimes described also as this fruit tree, where we've already eaten most of the very low-hanging fruits, and we need to get higher and higher up to get the really good fruits. And this is a very tall tree. So at some point, if you imagine it very tall, the ladder has to be so high, and it takes so much time and effort to climb up that it's not worth it anymore.
What do you hope for this new study? What does your team expect it will do?
Well, what we want to do is, first of all, we want to emphasize the research that has been done that pointed the proximity of the phenomenon and the dangers, so that it is taken serious. And then we want to go beyond, or we would like to see a process that takes us beyond the discussion of peak oil yes or peak oil no, because there's many reasons for why we should initiate a process towards a post-carbon economy. There's also climate change, for example, and resource limits per se, they can be positive because they give us the push in the right direction. So whereas a lot of people see peak oil as doom-mongering and say this is pessimism, I often say that I feel quite optimistic about it because it gives us opportunities to look in different directions.
Well, Christian Kirschner, you've picked a specialty which is real, it's important, and it's not very popular with the fossil fuel and mining industries right now. Do you feel resistance to people talking about resource limits?
Yes, one could say so. It's not the same with all oil companies, for example. There are some oil companies which do acknowledge peak oil. And some of them, I would say, they are not very many. But then the next question or next problem is, of course, what is the policy recommendation? And one not very desirable, in my opinion, is then that we need to drill more in order to make sure that we don't reach peak oil so fast.
Okay. And do you sense that there is a growing interest in peak oil and resource depletion in, say, the public or in governments?
In general, I would say yes. Again, I would say that the term peak oil is avoided in many of those debates. And in the U.S., because of the shale oil developments, or the shale gas developments, much better, there has been now this boom and this idea that peak oil is dead in a way. And many arguments why we don't agree with such a judgment, which I don't want to go into now. But in sustainability sciences, it's very much already an accepted fact. And also, there is already studies funded by national research bodies in order to look at, to make us more resilient and so on.
Well, listeners, I think this joint university work, Bridging the Atlantic, is a milestone for the study of peak oil and resources generally. You can find a link to the informative press release, plus the paper abstract, at least complete with the all-important graphs, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Our guest is Christian Kirschner, and he's from Europe, but he's working with the University of Maryland team as well. Thank you, Christian, for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith. You're about to hear a preview of my appearance on Peak Moment TV. The video will play on Community Access TV in the United States and other countries and on YouTube later this month.
This is Peak Moment. We are living at a peak of human innovation, information, wealth, and health. but we're also at a peak of population and consumption, with rising temperatures and declining resources fueled by cheap oil and gas. Peak Moment Television, bringing you examples of positive responses to energy decline and climate change through local community action.
Hi, welcome to Peak Moment. I'm Janaea Donaldson. I'm in Vancouver, BC, and I'm with somebody who's also in the media, Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. Radio EcoShock. Alex, give us a sense of what kinds of topics you try to cover in EcoShock and what you're trying to have people learn from your guests.
Well, it started out as an environmental show, but we also cover peak oil and energy issues. And occasionally we've touched on the economy if we think it's going to hit people directly. In the environment angle, we've mostly been covering two items, which is climate change, a lot on climate change. I think it's the number one issue that's going to face our generation and all the coming generations.
Yes.
And then we have also covered Fukushima quite a bit because partly we live on the West Coast and we got doused with some radiation here, but also it's another thing that's going to keep going for as long as you and I are alive, really.
And we'll be on. Thank you. Because those two, I turn to Radio EcoShock, what you're doing, because it feels to me that you are fearlessly putting out the data, the information. I mean, I certainly don't trust the mainstream. There's been so much climate denial in America, of course, paid for by corporate interests, that it feels like it's only just now poking its head up here and there in a way that's still not telling the whole story.
Well, it's just amazing to me, Janaea, that the people who are getting burned out of their homes or who are experiencing extreme floods or tornadoes or blowing them away tend to be the people who are voting in legislators, whether congressmen or senators, who are denying that climate change exists. It's the last desperate moment, I think, before the big realization sweeps across America. And that same battle is happening in other countries. It's happening in Australia and the UK. Europe, of course, greatly is ahead of us as far as realizing what's going on with climate change. But I'm hoping pretty soon the people in Texas that are sweating it out, and that if the air conditioning isn't working in Oklahoma, you can't go outside, you get fires coming earlier and earlier and staying later and later.
Yes.
I'm hoping all of those people will listen to what their own scientists are saying. And I do interview the scientists, and they have no doubt about what's going on.
Would you paint a picture for us of what, you know, you've learned so much through your guests. Can you sort of paint a picture for what is most likely unfolding?
Well, we had an understanding, we thought, of when climate change would begin to arrive. And we got that from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a group of scientists who have to report to governments, I might add, on what they say. And it looked like people were talking about 2040, 2050, we'd see the first really big hits. But the scientists that I talk to now have brought that way forward and say, no, it's happening now.
Yes.
We're getting it right now. We're seeing some sea level rise now. We're seeing storm surges like in Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. We're seeing the Arctic melt, which just blew everyone's mind, frankly. No one had expected that to happen.
Really?
There were no predictions for that.
Really?
No.
Actually, somebody just said to me that the IPCC panel did not include polar ice melt as in their original prognostications, their original
prognostications. No, they didn't even include it in their last report. They said, well, the science is too uncertain, so we don't know. But they had been talking about ice melt in the Arctic around 2075. So quite a bit
out. We're way ahead of time.
We're way ahead of time on that. And that is the one that really woke up people around the world, I think, especially people who are paying attention, that we have greatly altered the climate of the Earth already. The permafrost is starting to melt. We're at risk of this chemical called methane becoming a gas in the atmosphere.
Methane, let's go back on a sec. The methane hydrates, tell us a little bit about the science of that.
Well, there's two kinds of methane, really, that we have to be concerned about. Methane hydrates are at the bottom of the sea. They're a frozen, icy slush ball of methane. And they're called clathrates. That's the technical term. Now, they show some signs of melting off the low seabed near Siberia, in eastern Siberia. But it's not so serious that we're seeing extra methane in the atmosphere yet that we all have to panic. There is some people, you know, who are starting to panic. I think it's too early for that. But the other large source of methane is happening right where the tundra is, right melted from ages past. There were plant materials. The last time we had climate change, the last time we had global warming, there were alligators and crocodiles up around in the Arctic Ocean. So it was that warm. And we'll get that warm again if we continue the way we're going. All this plant material is just there waiting to melt. And when it does melt, if it's underwater, like ponds and rivers, it releases methane. If it's dry, it releases carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And methane's just such a dangerous gas because it's at least 12 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. And that's on the 100-year time scale. But what we care about is what's happening on a 10-year or 20-year time scale. And there it's 75 times more powerful. So we could get a jolt. We could get a big burst of warming. And some scientists believe, the ones that I talk to, the only reason we haven't seen it so far is because of an ocean cooling event happening now in the Pacific. And that's just a rhythmic event that happens from time to time. It's La Nina. Mm-hmm. That's happening instead of El Nino.
Mm-hmm.
When it switches back to El Nino, which it will, we may see a great deal of warming, and that means the kind of weather you would expect.
Which is?
You see more violent storms come when you have a hurricane. You may not have more hurricanes, but when you have a hurricane, it picks up heat right off the ocean and picks up extra moisture, and so you get these giant dumps of rainfall and extreme winds. As you had in Hurricane Sandy. That's exactly what happened there. That's exactly what happened with Hurricane Katrina.
I was going to say Katrina.
Other big example.
Got right into our faces with that, and the denial kept going on even after that.
It did, and parts of New Orleans have never been rebuilt and never should be rebuilt because you won't be able to hold on to them. But the thing that most people will experience is just that we just had a period here in Vancouver and in the West Coast where it was almost summer weather, even though it's the end of October. Well, that's the kind of change up you can expect. And you'll see earlier springs, and you'll have longer periods, especially in the American South or in Australia, where you get over 100 degrees for 3 months straight. Uncomfortable. Stinking hot.
Stinking hot. Well, we visited with friends who said, we already know that summer is arriving a couple weeks earlier, sting a couple weeks later. It looks like even this summer, what you're talking about, even further than a couple weeks later, and that they already consider themselves to be in a warmer zone plant-wise for planting, you know, when's the frost-free season, than they were even a few years ago, that it's already shifting the planting timeframes.
Well, they're right. I mean, the official agency that declares plant hardiness zones in the United States, for example, has already moved the zones further north. But the plants and animals know this too, and they're already moving towards the poles, and so are the fishes in the sea. So that we're seeing fish here that used to be in Northern California. And we're going to see more of that.
How extreme do you think it may get? What are you hearing from the scientists in let's say the next 20, 30 years?
I wish we knew.
Well,
we're running a great big experiment on planet Earth. I would say the majority of the scientists of the world feel that it will proceed fairly slowly. And then there are perhaps 20% of the scientists, and some of them are at the top of their field. We'll include James Hansen of the United States, for example, or my recent guest, Dr. Peter Ward. There are many scientists who feel that we could experience a jump in temperatures, as I said before, in which case we'll see more extreme events earlier. We don't know the timetable. What we do know is it won't stop even now. Even if we stop using fossil fuels, we will have some climate change, but it will become much worse if we don't stop using fossil fuels.
And does anybody have any optimism about that happening? I mean, that's a very negative way to say it, a pessimistic way of saying it. But so far, I've just seen a lot of, well, the United States is a grand example of foot dragging.
Well, I wouldn't go that far because actually the United States has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions since about 2008. Now, part of that was due to the economy.
Sure.
There was less industry putting out pollution, and industry is a major source of pollution. But also, Americans started buying more fuel-efficient cars, which was a major breakthrough. Detroit in the George Bush years said, oh, we can't get to 22 miles to gallon. We just can't do it. And now they're putting out cars that get 45 miles to gallon, and people are buying them. Right. So that's a major change up. And there are other reasons that it's happening. People are driving less. So I can see that even if people don't believe in climate change, just for economic reasons with the higher price of oil, they're making some better decisions in some countries. Unfortunately, we're losing all of those benefits because China is wanting to become industrialized too, and their coal burning is so extreme it's overcome any advantage that the United States reductions might have had.
So, and again, we're not at the level of international concern and agreements, I mean, because China wants to move up in the world, if you will.
No, our emissions are increasing. There's no question about it. They were increasing at about 2% per year. Last year, it was about 3% per year. And that 1% is a gigantic amount of carbon gone into the atmosphere. So we're chugging away towards a climate catastrophe, really. And I'm not just making that up. That's what the scientists that we talk to are saying. Whether we can avoid it or not will depend on a mass change in consciousness around the world. And when that will come or whether it will come in time is something we don't know yet.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, there are a lot of vested interests probably wanting to keep with the status quo because of the economic system, you know, and the economic benefits for that until it begins to hurt, I suppose. And some of the industries say it benefits us to reduce the carbon.
Yes. Unfortunately, the main drivers of our economy right now, I would say, is gas and oil, especially here in British Columbia, for example, where they want to build liquid natural gas production facilities and just got elected by saying we're going to produce a lot more of it. And we have the tar sands in Alberta. The United States has shale oil and so on, and fracking.
Fracking
is very inefficient. It's as bad as coal by the time you go all the way down the supply chain for natural gas. Yes,
fracking, which is you know the horizontal drilling for natural gas. And my understanding is that it's polluting wells. It's creating a horrible mess.
Yes, and from a greenhouse perspective, it's just awful. After they get the well drilled, they leave it open for a couple of weeks, and they either flare it, which is just putting more carbon in the atmosphere, or they let it all go into the atmosphere, which puts plus toxic chemicals and a lot of methane and a lot of dirty materials. They can't cap it until it gets cleaner, and then they can use it.
Oh, wow.
But all down the pipeline system, the pipelines leak, the storage systems that they use emit more methane, and then they have to put them into older city distribution systems, which you can go around with a truck and measure the methane from them, and you get huge spikes coming out all over the place where our cities are actually leaking methane. You can make a map and a visual of what they look like. So natural gas, I'm sorry, it's just as bad as coal, and it's not going to work as a bridge fuel. It's a bridge to nowhere.
Mm. Well, it's a bridge to worse climate emissions, more greenhouse gases.
Right. More storms, more rising seas. My recent guest, Peter Ward, says rising seas is the number one thing to worry about with climate change. South Florida, for example, will no longer be on the map by 2100 to 2150 just because of the glaciers that are melting in Greenland and to some degree in Antarctica. They put so much extra water in the sea and the seas expand when they're heated. And South Florida, the highest point is about 12 feet off the ocean. Miami is already getting a lot of flooding in the streets, and that's just the start of it. So within the next 10 or 20 years, some people will be rethinking their investments in Miami real estate, period.
I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. You're listening to my own appearance on Peak Moment TV with Janiyah Donaldson. I'm summarizing what I've learned from the scientists, authors, and activists you've heard over the past 7 years on Radio EcoShock.
Actually, I just came across a map showing scientists who were doing forecasts on when we would see sea level, certain seacoast cities all over the world, what year they would be, you know, the water would be at their level. This is, of course, forecast. In a business as usual scenario and in a reduced emission scenario. Mm-hmm. And the earliest was in the 2020s. I can't tell you whether it was Florida or who it was, but it's like they did that through the whole world, that you can start to see things starting to just sea level rise.
I'll tell you a surprising thing. The sea is not level. We base all our maps and everything. We say, oh, this is so many feet above sea level. The sea isn't level. There's as much as 100 feet difference in different parts
really?
Of the world. Yes. Because the oceans are attracted to the mass that's on the bed of the sea.
Oh, sure.
Just as the moon changes the ocean, so does the different mass of the Earth.
Thank you for that. I always wondered why you'd have to have the Panama Canal with the Pacific and the Atlantic at two different heights. It's like, thank you. I've been asking that one for years. So, Alex, what you're saying is what we should, that's the thing that your latest guest saying, worry most about the sea level rise.
Yes.
Because we have so many major ports, seacoast cities, what are they going to do? Or what could they do?
Well, they'll start off by doing what New Jersey is doing, which is rebuilding what they had before. A giant mistake. Nature has already told you what is going to happen. You can put up sand berms, but only so high, and eventually those flood over. Some of the cities will do, as London is doing and as Rotterdam has done, but they'll put up sea gates to try and hold back the tides and the surges. And that could work, possibly as long as 2050. After that, most of the scientists say it's just not going to work. You're going to have to build your ports higher, move some cities back further inland. Some ports, like the city of Alexandria, where the temples are already underwater, that will be what you will find in 2100, 2050 for some American and world ports.
One of my questions has to do with the interaction of positive feedback loops. That is, my understanding was that the IPCC reports didn't attempt to fit in how, say, melting polar caps, polar ice, bring more dark land into view, which means things are going to warm even more quickly. They didn't attempt to do that kind of multiplication effect, I guess is maybe what I should say. Have any of your guests talked about that?
Absolutely. That's one of the prime concerns of almost all of my guests, is how those things will interact, the feedback loops. And we just don't know. And scientists have found about 27 of them. There are all kinds of ways that these things interact. The world is a very complex system. It's a geochemical, physical, natural. Life changes, you know, if the plankton in the sea changes, a lot of things change. So we don't know. As I said, it's just one big experiment, and we're doing a kind of brinksmanship, especially our leadership, who have the reports available to them and don't call on the right experts to listen to and don't take the leadership role to make the changes in society that we all need. We have to elect the right people, but even when they're elected, they have to do the right things. I hope President Obama's listening when we talk about the Keystone XL pipeline.
Boy.
That's the wrong thing.
Absolutely.
To allow that to happen.
Yeah, that's, well, James Hansen, one of your guests, has said that game over. If the Keystone, I mean, that may be an exaggeration, it may not, that the Keystone pipeline, that tar sands oil comes on down through the U.S. and gets refined and sent out and burnt in the air.
Well, one of the things that haunts James Hansen was that he began his career at NASA studying Venus. Venus is very hot. It has an atmosphere that's almost entirely carbon dioxide. And so it has a giant greenhouse world is what it is. There is some evidence that on either Venus or on Mars, there may have been conditions closer to what we find on Earth. There may even have been water on Mars. There's some indication that. Why did their atmosphere burn off? Is it possible? Is it even in some science fiction world possible that the atmosphere of Earth could go out of control? Most scientists believe it won't because we have had warming incidents in the past and it didn't. But none of them have happened so fast as we're making it happen now. So we don't really know. And I think that's what Hansen's worried about is we could set things in effect that would change the world so dramatically that there will be no future human life. And I've spoke also to oceanographers and paleoclimatologists who have said that there is a type of microbe in the ocean that puts out hydrogen sulfide. And instead of oxygen, they put out hydrogen sulfide, which is a toxic gas to all of us mammals. They believe that is the cause of four previous mass extinctions on planet Earth. The oceans warm to a point where this type of microbe or plankton starts into effect. And that's why the dinosaurs survived and we did not. Their lung system was different. They could tolerate a certain amount of hydrogen sulfide. Mammals could not. There were a couple of little burrowing mouse-like pre-mammals that did survive. That's the only reason you and I are here. But that the reptiles could survive with this type of change in the ocean. So we don't want to see that happen. And it happens when oxygen goes down in the ocean. And that's what's happening right now. It's happening in the North Pacific. There are dead zones forming off the coast of Oregon. There are dead zones off the coast of Florida. And when we say dead zone, there's just no oxygen for life to live.
Wow. Yes. So that could tip into that kind of situation.
Another gigantic tipping point. If it happened, we hope it would take 100 or 200 years. But if it happens, we would become extinct. It's a real possibility. And people are just playing with this. It's amazing. I mean, I love my kids. I love my grandkids. I don't want them to have to suffer for the idea of us driving to the corner grocery store for a bottle of pop when we could have walked and it would have been better for our health anyway. So we can get into the solutions there. They're easy enough. They're right there. We can do it. We can do it with solar. We can do it with wind. We can do it with geothermal energy. We don't have to run ourselves off this planet.
I like that pitch. And the good news with the folks that we're meeting through Peak Moment TV are doing those kinds of changes. Whether or not they're doing it because of climate change, probably not, or even peak oil. Some of them are aware of those things, of course. But people that are wanting to relocalize, make more local, their economy, their gardens, you know, building materials that come from their region. I certainly see that pulse happening.
All of those solutions help the climate tremendously. There's no question about it. If you're growing your own beans and canning them from the backyard instead of flying them in from Chile, you are helping out. So we talked about the bit of good news that the United States, for example, has reduced its emissions. Mm. Well, the other side of that good news is that millions of people are taking an interest in where their food comes from and getting good, healthy food locally. And millions of people are interested in building public transit. As soon as you build a public transit line, it's full. We just need the leadership and we need the fossil fuel industries to back off their campaigns of denying climate change and pushing more and more development. They have to realize that they are a sunset industry.
Yes.
And
yes.
Go ahead and plan that way. We need our pension funds to realize that investing in fossil fuels is disinvesting in our human future and stop doing that. So there are a lot of positive things that is happening and that could happen a lot more.
Yes. For sure. I'm thinking about the students who've done campus campaigns to get their campus divested from the oil, the fossil fuel industries. I mean, they're the ones that are, whose future is being forfeited or severely contracted. I'm really glad to see young people making noise about it, being do action.
Right. Well, are we ready to switch up to the other big topic that's kind of threatening us all?
That. Yes. Talk to us about radioactivity in the broadest sense.
Yes. The Earth has a lot of radioactivity in it, but we evolved to that level so that we can handle the radioactivity that's there naturally. I mean, okay. That just makes sense.
Sure.
But humans have gone underground and grabbed a lot more and concentrated it in the most amazing ways. We make a special type of uranium for atomic power plants, and then we make plutonium and uranium for nuclear weapons. We blew off a lot of it in the 1950s and 60s in gigantic bombs, and all of that is still in our bones and may be one of the prime causes of the cancers that are now sweeping a generation. We think that's the case. We can't prove it as yet, but we do know that there is more radioactivity now than there was before 1950, and it's because of nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants, which also emit radioactivity every day. They don't have to leak to emit radioactivity. There is tritium and other materials coming out of every nuclear reactor, and there are about 400 of them on the Earth. The biggest problem, too, is there's been no storage, Janaya, for the waste products, they call them, of nuclear power. But the waste products are not benign. They are still immensely radioactive. And they have to be kept either underwater or in cement caskets in order, you know, to keep people safe or relatively safe around them. Now, what happened at Fukushima, Japan? They had four old reactors that were American designed by General Electric. And they had the tsunami, which washed over them, took out their source of external power. Now, it's amazing to me. Here is a plant that will go ahead and produce all kinds of power, all kinds of electricity. But if it doesn't have electricity coming from the outside, it breaks down. And that's what happened at Fukushima.
Okay.
They can run for a few hours on batteries, but even the battery system and their backup diesel generators were washed over by the sea and wiped out. So after a few hours, their reactors began to heat up, and then they melted down, a classic meltdown system in three reactors, which has never been seen before on planet Earth. They went right down through the bottom of the containment system, went down into the bottom of the reactor building, which was by then flooded. And now the Japanese authorities will tell you they don't know where these nuclear fuels are. There's plutonium in there. There's all kinds of wild and weird radioactive materials in there. They don't know where they are. They're down there under the ground there somewhere. Who knows? So what they're doing is they're pumping millions of gallons of water in and out, trying to collect the radioactivity before it hits the Pacific Ocean.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Where's that water? I mean, that's contaminated water. That's radioactive
Highly
water.
Contaminated.
Where's that water going?
Well, they collect most of it. And most of it is going into storage tanks. They've got, I believe, up to about 1,000 storage tanks on the site now. They're building them all the time. It's like a new industry in Japan, just building storage tanks for the Fukushima system.
Wow.
Unfortunately, the storage tanks are just kind of bolted together, and they've got all kinds of mishmash of pipes leading to them, and they've leaked. There was a big leak in August, another one in October, and when they leak, they just flow over these tiny little containment areas and down into the Pacific Ocean. So we've had tons and tons of radioactive, highly radioactive water go into the Pacific Ocean just in the last 3 months, not to speak of all the stuff that went in there when they had the accident in 2011.
Wow. Alex, what I've read is, and they don't know how long it will take. They don't know quite how to do this. They don't know. I mean, they haven't planned for this kind of scenario.
In fact, the Japanese government has just admitted they don't know what to do. They've asked for international help. And what surprises me is there's been no offer of international help. The Americans have been advising, and this should be a world project.
Mm-hmm.
Every country
mm-hmm.
in the world, and especially every country on the Pacific,
yes.
should be deeply, yes. deeply involved in this. Because when the accident happened, a lot of radioactivity was carried in the air straight over the whole West Coast. We measured it in Simon Fraser University, went and measured it in Vancouver area. It was measured down at the University at Berkeley in San Francisco. It was measured in Washington State. And it kept going from there in lesser amounts right over the whole of the United States and right around the whole Northern Hemisphere. It was measured in Scandinavia and in Europe and even into Russia. So it was a worldwide event of radiation sprayed over the world. Ever since then, though, it's been coming into the Pacific. The Pacific's a big place. So far, it's being diluted to an extent, but neither the Canadian or American governments have released any testing on fish to tell us whether, for example, the salmon coming back, are they safe to eat? The fisheries that go out into the far Pacific and catch fish, tuna, and everything else, and bring it back, is it safe? We don't know. They're not telling us. There's no figures. Are they testing it? We don't know that either.
Which, of course, leads one to think the worst. They're not telling us because there would be a panic. The fishing industries would probably collapse, all that kind of... That's the first thought
yes.
in terms of government cover-ups. I have heard of one report of something like 12 or 15 bluefin tuna down in Southern California, all of whom had higher levels of radiation.
Well, this coming year of 2014 is when the radiation will have definitely reached far enough to reach the West Coast, mm-hmm. just the way the ocean circuits work. And it will keep on coming because they don't have it under control. Neither the operator TEPCO nor the Japanese government have Fukushima under control. So when they have typhoons, as they just had two or three of them, and a tropical storm wash over,
right.
this stuff just washes down through the groundwater, through those lost radioactive cores, and out into the ocean, and it will keep circulating for decades, I would say, unless we can bring it under control somehow. The Japanese have said, well, maybe we'll freeze all the ground all around the reactor site. It's a gigantic multi-billion dollar project, never been done before. Don't know if we can do it, but until something happens, this is worse than Chernobyl in the way that it's continuing.
Yeah, so I'd read something, you know, three times, maybe more than that, radiation compared to Chernobyl.
It is, but most of it went into the Pacific, which is the good news and the bad news,
right,
as far as humans are concerned that live on land. And there's one last thing we should talk about when it comes to Fukushima, and that is that the nuclear fuel rods, especially in this building called Building 4, mm-hmm. that were perched up above the reactor, the buildings were severely damaged by explosions. They're just teetering there. And the Japanese have tried to build them up with special reinforcing structures, and they've done a decent job on Building 4, but it's still not ready should there be another earthquake. They have earthquakes there all the time, running up to 4, 4.5. It's quite normal for that area. If they have one that's 6 or 7, Building 4 could collapse. And there are various nuclear experts who I give a lot of credit to who have warned that is the single biggest threat to mankind in the Northern Hemisphere. Because if Building 4 collapses, there's radioactivity in there that has just never been seen before, released at one time on planet Earth. So that's something to worry about and something to keep your eye out for. I don't know what we could do. Really, there's nothing you or I can do if that happens.
You know, it occurs to me as you say that, because you and I aren't going to affect what's happening there, it sort of underscores enjoying each day, enjoying the lives we have now, you know, being good to each other. I mean, which sounds really simplistic, and yet what I hear is a higher level of uncertainty that what may happen out of Fukushima, because they're in an earthquake zone, we may have that kind of terminal event with more illness. You know, more
it's possible cancer would
it's
spread
possible.
Wildly if it happened. I'm hoping it won't happen.
Of course.
And I think there are some things we could do. And one of the things we could do is there are about 22 of the same design reactors, and they're fatally flawed design from General Electric, mm-hmm. that have the fuel rods come up from the bottom. And that means there are holes in the bottom. And if they have an accident, the nuclear fuel cuts directly down, and we could have Fukushima's in the United States.
Wow.
So number one is get a hold of your congressman or senator and say, I don't want a Fukushima in the United States. If we're running these Mark I General Electric reactors, shut them down today. Get a hold of
That's
the
good.
Nuclear Regulatory Commission and shut those down. America has enough power, it can run without them. We don't need that electricity. So that's a no-brainer. We found out what happens in Fukushima mm-hmm, if there's mm-hmm, an accident. Mm-hmm. And we've had some near misses in the United States, like when that reactor in, I think it was North Dakota, was flooded. And there were floods all around it. If the power lines went down, bingo, there you go.
Yes.
So in the short term, get rid of those reactors. In the longer term, no more nuclear power.
Yes,
it doesn't
of course.
Work.
Of course.
It's too dangerous for humans to run. If we had a perfect world, the physics of them make sense. But in a real human society, we haven't made them fail safe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for laying out. It's better that we know than we pretend otherwise. Any other things that are sort of close to your mind or your heart that you know, that you've sniffed out through EcoShock that you want to add?
Well, on Radio EcoShock, I do spend a lot of time talking to the more hopeful people who are trying to do the things that you cover in Peak Moment TV. And it's localization, and it's food production, and it's gardening, and it's community building.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's also psychological preparation that the world may not continually improve. That's what we were told during the time we were growing up. And in fact, the world may become more difficult and more challenging. But humans can rise to those challenges socially. As long as we don't wipe ourselves out with climate change mm-hmm. or nuclear power mm-hmm. or toxic pollution, we can rearrange our society. We can become more flexible. We can expect less materially and more in happiness. And I think that's the real key to how we will survive.
I think that when you think of the evolutionary sense, what cultures did were, you know, you either flee if things get bad, you go elsewhere, which of course civilizations have done, or you have to adapt, and there is no somewhere else. I mean, we've got planet Earth, and it's all feeling the effects. So that adaptability, that flexibility, the creativity, I mean, that's part of what I see in Peak Moment that's really exciting, is people are rising with levels of creativity on how to do different economies or different money or different food systems and that are more perennial. And it's encouraging. It's really
yes.
encouraging.
And there's people of all
that.
Ages, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm seeing seniors come out with a lot. I'm seeing young people in their 20s come out with a lot. And even I just listened to a speech by a 12-year-old girl from British Columbia at PowerShift 2013. And she's a powerful speaker. So even the kids, you know, and their fridge magnets and their artwork, they're saying, we want a change. We want a good world.
And I thank you because part of what you're doing in laying out the Radio EcoShock is you do, you want a better world, and part of it's being informed about what's going on and what we can do. Thank you for that. Okay, we're going to get on the line and get our American nuclear plants closed up. Thank you.
Oh, I appreciate the chance to talk with you and with your viewers.
You're watching Peak Moment TV. I'm Janaea Donaldson. My guest is Alex Smith, the host and producer of Radio EcoShock. Thank you. Join us again.
My appearance on Peak Moment TV will be broadcast on Community Access Television and on YouTube later this month. I'll tip you off when it comes out. You can help Radio EcoShock keep going. Make a donation at our website, ecoshock.org. I've been a fan of Peak Moment TV for a couple of years now, so I took this opportunity while I was in Vancouver to ask host Janaea Donaldson how it all got started and why she thinks we are living in that peak moment of human history.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and I'm here with a source that you should really know about. It's called Peak Moment TV. And I'm here with the host, Janaea Donaldson, and I'm going to let her explain what she is doing and why you should know about it.
Thank you, Alex. That's wonderful. Peak Moment TV originated when I learned about peak oil, and that was about 2005. Prior to that, my partner Robin and I were already tuned into climate change through Bill McKibben, but I thought peak oil might be the place where our wallets would start to create changes in behavior when the economy, you know, felt the effects of cheap oil going away. We started Peak Moment TV because we wanted to let our neighbors know about what was going on. And when I say peak moment, my sense of this isn't just this year or even just this decade, but that we're at an arc of a peak moment in history, certainly a peak of certain resources, the non-renewables, and enormous population, that we would need to see contraction in the material sense of not a consumer society. So what my first question is, if it's going to be a whole lot more expensive to get food in my town, my little rural town in Northern California, where will that food come from? Well, it has to come from my local area. So we started videoing shows with people who may not have been thinking about peak oil per se, or may not have been thinking about climate change, but were looking at local food, growers markets, permaculture, natural building, local money. So that's where it started, and we began to find more and more people all through the Northwest. We would travel. We have traveled. We are traveling and finding the creativity, the innovation, the ideas, people trying things, becoming more neighborly, taking care of each other, sharing tools, sharing cars. It's hopeful signs everywhere about people in this peak moment coming together on their local level. So Peak Moment TV is at peakmoment.tv on the web. We have, at this point, 245 shows, free, all on the internet. And we find that people are changing their lives, being inspired by them, which makes us feel really good, really glad to do that. You know, it's one of those little signs of hope at this point. The people that we're getting to meet, the brain being inspired by all over.
I'm trying to do more of that. I went to the Mother Earth News Fair, and I met about 13 people there that were really inspiring. They had come as speakers, and we ran a series of interviews on Radio EcoShock. Everything like aquaponics, for example, very interesting topic, raising fish with food
yes.
in a whole natural cycle. there are a lot of great ideas out there. I just spoke with Lawrence Boomert of New Zealand, mm-hmm. and he has the Bank of Solutions.
Yes, the Bank of Real Solutions.
Bank of Real Solutions.
Yes,
isn't that great?
We just interviewed him, so we'll have some of that up on Peak Moment. Yeah, it is. And his solutions include the alternate monies, and when the government couldn't pay for adult education anymore, they had their alternate money exchange ready to go, and they just kept going on with doing their classes, you know, without the currency, you know, the New Zealand currency. Those are great examples. We videoed some folks, speaking of hydroponics, there's a show that we just put out within the last few months of folks doing exactly what you're talking about with the hydroponics, you know, in their center. It's very small, starting out place. I think that probably some of the folks you met at Mother Earth News, what people most want to know on the Peak Moment channel is, what can we do at the individual and family level? What can we do in our backyard? And then they start to think about, well, what can my neighbor and I or the folks up the street do together? We visited folks in Victoria at McCaskill Street who got together, learned a bit about what they could do, you know, for a transition to less energy. So they looked at energy and food and water, found out that there was a new kind of efficient heat pump. And all of them had got rebates so that for nearly free, they have far more efficient space heating because they got together as neighbors and learned about that. You know, I think that's where the hope lies, is down here in the grassroots.
You talked about Peak Oil. I just did an interview with a fellow from Berlin who is part of a joint study in both Europe and the United States. The University of Maryland was involved on Peak Oil. And I thought, well, Peak Oil, yes, Richard Heinberg, yes, mm-hmm. a lot of us who have been doing alternative thinking. But no, it's being studied by universities and it's being studied by the military, by a lot of people who can see that oil is not just a free thing that comes out of the earth forever. It's definitely limited. And he was saying that, well, we have to redefine what Peak Oil is. Really, it's not that we're going to run out of oil. It's that it just gets more and more expensive, dirtier and dirtier to produce, harder and harder to find. And that's exactly what we have with the tar sands, what we have with deep water drilling, and oil's, you know, $90, $100 a barrel these days. It's pretty expensive.
Yes.
So I think that people are going to experience that for sure. Do you cover that in your program?
We have. We haven't done an update in a couple of years, but we do cover exactly what you're saying, that it's going to become more expensive as it gets dirtier, as it gets harder, and it already is. I mean, we're already in America, at gas prices that were right at the point where it broke the bank, if you will. It caused the collapse in 08, a part of the collapse in 08. And people are feeling that pinch. We're just at that edge. We have not covered, and I do want to cover, fracking, because I think that people are being given the story that that's gonna be the bridge. That'll take over for where the more expensive oil is, and I see that not happening. So we'll probably do some updates on that. Because what bottom line was going to matter to the ordinary person is, how am I going to feed my family? You know, the economics of living. And those are the places where people can have the most effect, is how they choose to live their lives. It's part of why we see people sharing houses, living in tiny houses, things that will allow them to physically maybe appear to be less wealthy. But it's being balanced, as you said, in relationships that are more nurturing, that are healthier, that are making up for the less in the material world.
Well, Janaea, you mentioned that it's Peak Moment TV. Where's the TV part?
Well, somebody just told us we should call it, it's Tell-A-Vision. So that even though it's on the internet, we are on the internet and we are on community TV stations in America and a couple of other places in the world. So people can find us at peakmoment.tv. There's also a Peak Moment channel on YouTube. But the TV, of course, is a throwback to television, because we're not on the big flat screen televisions, unless you have that. We're on the internet. But we really do have a lot of guests who are just ordinary folks who really are telling their vision of coming into and thriving in a very different world that's more contracted physically, but richer from the inside.
Well, I've watched a bunch of episodes that you have going on the net, and I've really enjoyed them. So you have been one of my favorite spots to visit.
You're sweet, Alex.
No,
thank
it's true.
You. Thank you.
I've learned a lot. You have some good guests, and we all have to learn. It's a re-education process all the time. So I really want to thank you for joining me on Radio EcoShock, Janaea Donaldson of Peak Moment TV.
Thank you, Alex. It's been nice to be here.
Check out the Radio EcoShock weekly show blog at ecoshock.info for more links to Peak Moment TV and some recommended programs to watch. Next week, we'll visit the best of the Chicago Great Lakes Bioneers Conference. Support Radio EcoShock if you can at the website ecoshock.org and grab free MP3s of our past programs while you're there. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.